Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 17 and I am sitting as always with Dan Farrant. How's it going, Dan?
Doing well, Rob. How about you?
Very good indeed. What's been going on this week?
What's been going on this week? Just been working a bit. Nothing really to report.
You did a stunning job of going first in the American overdub show.
Oh, I enjoyed that. That was... We did pretty well, I think.
Yeah, I got some very good feedback.
Did you? What did people say?
That it was really funny and enjoyable to listen to.
Which, I think it was funnier for us.
Yeah, I got into it. By the second half, the outro of the show, I was really in the zone.
Yeah.
I managed not to speak over you at all.
You did well on the comebacks.
And then the Mark Lockhart thing that I mentioned, meeting him on the plane, was just so weird because
that's very random.
He was only three rows behind me, and I didn't notice him until 6.5, like 7 hours in.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy.
It's so tantalizing. We must have been so close. We must have crossed paths.
How many times that happens without knowing.
Yeah, that really does itch me.
Because I wonder what other jazz musician was on that flight.
There was another dude on there, did I tell you?
No.
A guy got on in a tux with a tenor and a bass clarinet.
Ooh.
I told Mark of him. I was like, hey, there's this dude up, you know, in the next cabin.
Yeah.
But obviously the signs for flying with Virgin with your instruments are very good because he had a tenor and a bass, just as hand luggage, and they went in the overhead bins.
Happy days.
I know. So today is Jim Hart.
Jim Hart.
Yes.
Great.
This is our first tuned percussionist episode.
He's also a drummer.
He is also a drummer, but I like to ignore that. Okay. I like to stereotype and typecast and try and compartmentalize him.
Yeah,
because,
sure.
You know, I think it's only fair that we make as many assumptions about people's careers as we can.
What other tuned percussion is there other than... I can't even remember what instrument he plays.
He's a vibraphone.
Vibraphone, that was it. I was thinking marimba.
Mm.
I couldn't marimba.
I think the vibes and the marimba are really the scene.
Yeah.
I can't imagine like a soprano glockenspiel being something you can forge a major career in.
Mm.
It'd
be good if you did though, wouldn't it? I mean, you can get like a jazz harmonica player who plays the chromatic harmonica.
I've never heard that done well. That's very interesting.
Have. Yeah, properly. It's crazy. Yeah, it's very good.
I was on the subway last week and there was a dude on there playing guitar and harmonica and singing. And the guitar was okay. The singing was okay.
Mm.
But the harmonica, basically the guitar's kind of in E and the harmonica's definitely in C. And he just made no effort to accommodate the two.
Yeah.
It sounded so... Right. It was either like so bitonal that it was beyond me or it was just awful.
Oh dear. How was America? Did you have a good time?
Yes, it was very nice. Especially getting to see New Orleans for a few days.
Yeah.
That was just really really eye-opening as to how much live music there is, how many venues are willing to put on live music and support a lot of local artists that don't necessarily have a big name for themselves outside of the city. Something that would be very nice to have more of in London. But it's the election tomorrow, so...
Well, it was yesterday when this comes out.
Oh, yeah, it's the election yesterday.
Rob, who are you going to call?
Calling it right now. Corbyn has won by a monstrous margin.
Oh, I'm going opposite. I'm saying May. I'm saying May's won by a huge margin.
I think if Corbyn wins, I doubt it will be a a colossal, you know, barnstorming victory. It'd be nice, though. I read something about subsidies for small venues to be able to afford live music, I think. For the jazz podcast, of course, I get a vote, you get a vote, and the podcast also has a voting card. It's registered in Wimbledon, so I'll go wearing the shirt and we can make a voice.
Yeah, mate, let it be heard.
Oh, yes. So, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Hart.
Hello.
How's it going, Jim?
Very good. Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for coming on. It's our pleasure to talk to you. So, where are you at the moment?
I'm at home, which is in Alsace in France.
Oh, lovely.
East side of France, just on the border with Germany and Switzerland.
Cool. When did you move there?
January 2014, so a little over 3 years ago.
How's it been since you left the UK?
Yeah, it's good. It was a kind of a sort of strange couple of years, the first couple of years of loads of massive changes all at once. Kind of some projects winding up and some ways of working inevitably coming to an end, like, you know, doing sort of one-off gigs or last-minute things or kind of one-off collaborations.
Yeah.
They were just no longer really viable unless I was already in the UK. So there was these kind of big holes that opened up in my schedule. But that was kind of that was fun trying to fill them and meeting, you know, at the same time I've been meeting other people and doing new things here and getting new projects going. So it was kind of a weird transition period of something stopping and then other things taking a little while to get going. So there were some big gaps, but that's kind of given me a chance to get to know where I live. And yeah,
that's really cool. It must be so hard to move as a musician, like to leave a city, or I mean even more to leave, and leaving a city is bad enough, never mind getting out of the country.
Yeah. I was trying to leave London for years. I love London to bits, but after I'd been there for 10 years, I said I was going to leave. And initially I was going to move to Brighton because I grew up in Cornwall and I sort of had a pining to be close to the water, to the sea. And so I was going to move to Brighton. And then that I kind of bottled it. The idea of having to circumnavigate the M25 every time I needed to do a gig in the southeast sort of scared me off.
Yeah, too much to bear. I'm
so I stayed in London, and it was another nearly 9 years before I moved here. So I stayed there kind of twice as long as I expected to. But yeah, I mean, as you say, leaving a city is hard to do because there's always so much going on, and you think, oh well, I'll just do this thing, and then maybe I'll think about going, and then something else comes in. Yeah. So it's
Before we get too into it, can you try and explain who you are for people that don't know you?
Sure, yeah. Because
I tend to gloss over that bit, and then the poor audience, a surprisingly large number of which aren't like hardcore jazz users, sort of tolerate listening to the shows with relatively little idea of what the hell is going on.
That's very sympathetic of them.
Yeah, I know. So I need to start.
I'm not sure I could do that.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us, if it's possible, like who you are and why.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jim Hart, and I grew up in Cornwall, in the UK, and I'm a musician. I'm a vibraphone player and a drummer primarily. And I write my own music and lead my own bands. Currently, that's the Cloudmakers, which is in two different formats. The Cloudmakers Trio, which has been going for about 7 years now, and more recently Cloudmakers 5, which has been playing since the beginning of this year. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about those projects later.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'm also a sideman and play in a number of other people's bands, including Marius Nesset, I've worked for a long time with Ivo Neem in various different projects, and I moved to France a couple of years ago, and I'm playing with a number of French musicians out here as well. I was at Cheetham School of Music from 16
to
2 years. Yeah, you were there too, right?
Shit, yeah, I didn't realise.
Yeah.
When were you there?
So 94 to 96.
Oh man, I started just like 2 years after you left then.
Okay. Yeah, so I moved from Cornwall to Cheetham's.
Right, so let's slow it down because this is the bit, this is super interesting. Whereabouts in Cornwall did you grow up?
So on a little farm on the edge of Bodmin Moor, the southwest corner of Bodmin Moor, near a little village called St Neot, which is near a town called Lisgard.
Right. I've never spent so much of an episode on Google Maps, and we're only like 5 minutes in.
Oh.
I'm just zooming out of France and into Cornwall.
Okay, nice.
So what was the music like? How did you first get into the vibraphone or percussion, I suppose?
So, I started playing pretty young. There was a lot of music in the home already because my mum was really into folk music and sings and plays the guitar, and my dad plays the trumpet and piano a bit and was a choir master. He ran male voice choirs for a long time and now runs a mixed choir. So there was always kind of music going on around at home. And then my older brother, who's nearly 4 years older than me, plays the trumpet, and he had a teacher who was really into jazz. He was a jazz trombonist. He was the sort of local brass peripatetic teacher. And I was kind of, it was sort of inevitable, I suppose, that I would kind of start playing as well. And I got into playing drums and piano at the same age, which was around 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah.
My drum teacher was a guy called Russ Davies, who was a fantastic teacher, and he got me, you know, we started on kit, but he very soon got me playing tuned percussion.
Is that normal for people?
I think it's pretty common. Yeah, if you've got, I think a lot of, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a teacher who and some instruments where you're being taught as well, who's had a percussion background as opposed to just a drum kit background, then I think tuned percussion is quite common. Not everybody gets on with it, not everybody enjoys it. And I mean, I started playing xylophone, and I really enjoyed it. So that was cool, but it was quite a lot later that I got into vibes. Just to close that story. So my piano teacher at the same time was a great guy called Cecil Duval from Philadelphia, who had retired to Cornwall to sail Red Wing boats and teach music. And he was an amazing guy, and he got me into playing jazz pretty early, as well as playing some classical stuff and whatever I wanted, really. He was really keen on sort of, you know, music for enjoyment, play whatever you want, as a way of learning the instrument and learning to play. But so we did a lot of jazz with him, and he had a neighbor called Arthur who had like millions of instruments, like saxophones and trumpets and a vibraphone. And he kind of got old and unable to play and started giving all his instruments away, and he gave me a set of vibes when I was about 11.
Cool.
Which I've still got. It's an old Trixon set. I think it's from the like 40s or 50s.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really cool that you still have it as well.
Yeah.
Because I find the instruments sort of fall by the wayside as you like grow up and upgrade them and all that stuff.
My first kit fell by the wayside, unfortunately. I donated it to a primary school when I was a teenager, and I wanted a like a modern kit with double braced hardware and, you know, pinstripe heads, all horrible things. And I gave away a 1950s Premier Olympic.
Oh, man.
I regret it to this day.
Oh, that's horrible. You should go back there and find it and take it.
No, it's gone. I went back to try and find it and it's gone. But anyway, but yeah, no, so that was kind of how I got into vibes, playing vibes. But it was always a really secondary thing though. I was always playing piano and kit and kind of classical percussion, right up until I went to the Guildhall. When I first started studying jazz, I suppose.
Oh, cool.
In a institution. I mean, I was doing a lot of, as I said, I was doing a lot of jazz already with my piano teacher, Cecil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how did you find out about Cheetahms then?
It was a really last minute decision, actually. I'd done my GCSEs and I was doing Cornwall Youth Wind Orchestra, and I think there was a student there who had gone, and I don't know, I came home off one of the courses and spoke to my parents about it. And it was, I think it was a summer course. I was looking at a couple of different sixth form colleges in Cornwall to go, but I wasn't really that excited about it. And my brother had been to a sixth form college in Cornwall to do music and had dropped out of that course halfway through because he really wasn't enjoying it. And I think we were all a bit worried that that might happen to me. So I don't know, my parents just suggested one day they were like, well, have you thought about going to Cheetahms? And I was like, no, yeah, I'd love to. Great. Okay. So I went up and got a really last minute audition and got in and got a like a part scholarship, I think. And it just all happened really quickly. And it was great. I really loved being there, being thrown into this environment where, well, as you know yourself, you know, just everybody who's there is into music and is doing music. And
yeah,
it's just so inspiring, you know, walking around the school and seeing like nine-year-olds playing Rachmaninoff when they can't touch the pedals. You know? And then living in dorms with a bunch of other musicians and just staying up talking about music late until the night. It was amazing.
When I started, I was only 10, but I went as a day person because my family lived quite close by. And I realized after, like, I don't know when it would have been, but certainly by the end of that first year, I was well aware that being a day person was a disastrous error of judgment.
Okay.
Because, you know, I was going home and then, like you say, everyone's just hanging out and having a good time. And, oh, man, it used to kill me to go home.
Right.
No, sorry, Mum. I know you'll be listening to this. it was nothing personal.
I had a good friend who was a day person, Simon Williscroft, who's a great sax player.
We know Simon. He's coming on soon.
Oh, cool. Well, we'll say hi from me.
Sure.
But we were kind of in the little jazz, the jazz posse, and he lived in Stalybridge, so he would go home, and I quite often would go and hang out at his at the weekend. So that was kind of nice to have.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
to get a break from, because it's kind of intense as well at Cheetahms. It was.
It is. That's my secret to 8 year long success. Is
wow, being, you did 8 years.
You know, but yeah, being like you say, being able to leave, especially for my own place. Like if it all got too much, you could just go home at any given moment.
Yeah.
Which you don't have the luxury of if your family don't live close enough.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think more people could have benefited from that sometimes because, yeah, you kind of need a break from it at times. I mean, like my second year there, I was doing like Young Musician of the Year and gigging as well with Simon and I don't know, really busy, like principal percussion in the symphony orchestra and doing loads of jazz as well. And I was just doing too much and I ended up getting tendonitis and having to stop for a couple of months.
Oh God, that's awful.
It just all got sort of too much all at once.
Yeah.
For all the right reasons, but yeah, there was no kind of respite from it. You know, it's like, go, 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 go. Ah, stop.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that was a tough little moment.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And then who was your percussion teacher then when you were at school?
So Paul Patrick was my classical percussion teacher, and I had Dave Hext would come in and visit, who was principal of the Halle. So that's two great teachers there from the classical side. But the guy who was a really, you know, important, one of the most important teachers that I ever met was Dave Hassel, who was my kit teacher. And he was really amazing. I felt roasted, you know, consistently for 2 years, but in a really really encouraging way. And he was a very hardcore, disciplined teacher, but he was all about the music, and we really got on, and I got a lot out of him in a short period of time. It was a bit of a shock actually going to London after that. I felt like the trajectory kind of slowed down a little bit in terms of the my one-to-one kit teaching, at least. He had big shoes to fill. I definitely owe him a lot. He's a fantastic teacher.
Yeah, Dave's got such a kind of aura about him.
Yeah.
Because he's such a no-nonsense, you know, kind of guy.
Yeah.
I can imagine he's a unbelievable teacher because...
Yeah, he's also really knowledgeable, you know. I mean, he introduced me to loads of music. I mean, he would, you know, bring CDs in for me to borrow for the week. You know, that was like... I guess our generation was sort of the end of that thing where you wear one record out, you know, rather than everything being available on the internet as it is students now.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, a new record, a new album was a really precious thing, and you just kind of listened to it over and over and over and over and over again if you liked it.
Yeah.
Until you knew it sort of inside out, because you can't afford to just go out and buy another one.
No, of course.
You know, and that was those 2 years at Cheatham's were really like that. There was a trumpet player who was a couple of years younger than me, but who had an awesome CD collection called Ian Pratt. And I remember just like taping, you know, like an album on each side of a C90 cassette tape. And just like absorbing some of his record collection. And there was also a really great record shop in Manchester called Decoy Records, which I don't think is there anymore. Was it there when you were there?
No, it might have been. I never knew of it, actually. So I guess, you know, especially by the time...
The other side of the cathedral. I can't remember the name of the place, but it wasn't far. It was like a 10-minute walk. Mm,
I have a bad feeling about that then, because we used to sort of hunt around... There was a few places on Market Street. There was a little shop called Fop that used to have some cool, like jazz LPs, but I never anything closer than that.
Yeah, the Decoy was amazing. And there was a guy who worked there called John. I'll never forget him. He was just brilliant because I remember going in, sort of, I'd go and see a gig at Band on the Wall and some tune would get stuck in my head. And I'd run into Decoy Records the next day and like sing the tune. Like, you know this tune?
Sick.
And you'd be like, oh yeah, it's off this record. There's these different versions, you know. And like,
wow, that's amazing.
He was amazing. He really helped me sort of pick some of my first important albums, like John Scofield, Hand Jive, Kenny Wheeler, Double W.
Yeah.
Jared.
I love that one. That's with Michael Brecker.
Yeah.
And John Taylor.
That's the one.
Scene.
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of, you know, he was like my little sort of spirit guide of the CD shop. Scene. Great.
That's superb.
Yeah.
I love that about, I guess now is great because everything's everywhere, but I would always plan what I was going to buy next while I was absorbing something, you know, being like you'd like plot your course quite carefully.
Yeah.
I think everyone did about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like detective work in a way, isn't it? It's like kind of following a lead. You sort of
of course
you get kind of into a, you get exposed to a certain player at a certain period, and then you go into the, you open the book, you know, the Penguin book or whatever, and you look at what else they were doing at that time, and you sort of see a connection to something else that you've checked out, and you're like, oh wow, they played together, okay, I need to hear that record, what does that sound like?
Yeah,
and then finding out about labels and
I reckon my first ever like Pat Metheny experience was probably like, hey, this guy's cool. He plays as a sideman on loads of Brecca records, you know. And then you're like, wonder what he's done. Like, ah!
Yeah, yeah, it's like Pandora's box.
Yeah, precisely. So then if we – let's talk about Guildhall and why you went there after after school.
Yeah. So, I mean, I kept my options really narrow on applying for conservatoires, actually. So I just applied to the Royal Northern because I totally fell in love with Manchester when I was in at Chets. And the Guildhall, those were the only two that I applied to. And I kind of said to myself that if I got into the Guildhall, then I would go there because, you know, the whole London gravitational force is pretty hard to resist.
Yeah.
And I always said, well, I can always come back to Manchester afterwards, you know. So I went to Guildhall, and the reason that was the only London place that I applied to is because at that time it was the joint classical and jazz course had just been born. I think I was the second or third year of people to do it.
Oh, cool.
Third year, I think. And I, having done a lot of classical playing up until that point, I'd just done Young Musician of the Year, which had gone pretty well, and I kind of, you know, jazz was definitely really pulling me strong in that direction, but I kind of wanted to leave some doors open and leave my options open.
Yeah.
So I figured the Guildhall course was the right one for me. I was a little crestfallen when I got there, actually, because I think over that, you know, just over that short summer break between the end of Chets and Guildhall starting, I was just getting so deeply into jazz.
Yeah.
That by the time September came around and Guildhall started, I was like, oh, God, I've still got to do all this classical stuff. I really don't want to.
Yeah.
And in fact, I had to do way more classical stuff than I expected, and less jazz than I expected.
Oh no, that's a terrible
situation. I was kind of gutted in a way, and I think I was a bit immature. I was a bit young to deal with that, and it kind of spun me out, to be honest. And I kind of buffeted around that course for 18 months. Not really getting on so well. I kind of, you know, I failed a classical mid-year like repertoire exam, and like I'd never failed a music exam before, and it was like, okay, something's going wrong here. Something isn't right.
Yeah,
and I wasn't happy. I wasn't really enjoying myself. So I spoke to Martin Hathaway and Simon Purcell, who were co-running the undergrad course at that time, and you know, I said, look, you know, I'm not really feeling this. I'm not really happy, and I was living with a postgrad in Sandar Court in the Halls of Residence, and I you know, and the postgrad was an all jazz intensive course, and I was like, I really like what these guys are doing, you know.
Yeah.
Can I do that course instead? And they were amazing. They got me an audition to do the postgrad, having not done my undergrad. And in what would have been, so I took a couple of months out.
Wow, that's so unusual.
Yeah, I don't know.
I did not see this coming.
No, I didn't see it coming either. I don't know anyone else who's happened to. It was just I was in the right place at the right time and had the right people on my side. And
yeah. So you did a postgrad course, but then got an undergrad degree at the end of it.
I did a postgrad course in what would have been my third year.
Yeah.
And I didn't hand in my final history assignment, and I came out with nothing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Didn't see that coming either.
Nope. No. Guildhall was a strange time for me.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like the way I perceive you and your personality at all.
No, people say that. Whenever I tell that story, they're always like, oh, wow, you know, I thought you were really, like, academic and stuff. But, I mean, I certainly wasn't at that time. I was kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
I really feel like my higher education really started after Guildhall.
Right.
Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, I had some amazing input at Guildhall, and my lessons with Pete Churchill, both in the classes, in the harmony classes, and I had him one-to-one as a piano teacher as well, were amazing. That, you know, I put him up there with Dave Hassell as one of the most important people that I've come into contact with. Really amazing teacher. And I met loads of great musicians, and, you know, there were loads of positive sides of it. But, like, when I moved out, after Guildhall, I moved into this house in Golders Green with there were six of us, six jazz musicians. So it was Robin Finker, Sam Crockett, Dave Smith, Ollie Bedell, and a bass player called Richard Price, and myself. And we lived together. And there were a few changes, but Sam Crockett, Robin Finker, Dave Smith, and myself were there for nearly 10 years altogether.
Oh, wow.
And we formed the Loop Collective together, and they were all just like a couple of years younger than me. And so Dave and Robin were at the Guildhall, and Sam was at the Academy, and I was just going and hanging out with all of them and sort of soaking up stuff that they were getting from the two different conservatoires. And then we were doing our own thing in that house. We had Barak Shmuel living around the corner, and he would drop in and you know, do like rhythm workshops with us and
in the house. That's amazing.
Yeah. He'd like knock, there'd be, you know, we'd be hanging out, and there'd be a knock on the door, and it'd be Barak, like, on his way home from the Academy, and it's like, okay, that's the next 2 hours taken care of. You know, he's like, he's gonna come in and put some music on, some, you know, crazy West African stuff, and be like, okay, where's one?
Wow.
Is it here? No, it's not there. Try again. You know, like, it was really, yeah. It was, and he kind
I'm
of
just
encouraged
gonna fill, us. Sorry, Jim, to stop you, but in case anyone, this guy, Barak Shmuel, I want to just fill in the blank there.
Yeah, please do.
He's like the London authority on rhythm in general. Rhythms and music, and he teaches a lot at, like, I think he teaches at definitely the Academy and Trinity,
so he's, and City as well, I think.
He's always spoke really proudly of those, that job, in class, and he's like the Larry David of percussion.
And he runs a great samba band called Rhythms of the City, which I think an awful lot of musicians have gone through at some point.
Yeah.
Which is, a great sort of institution.
But to get Barak coming to your house, that's awesome. To come on.
Lessons in fatherhood, sorry.
Oh, boy. I noticed on your Skype picture you have a little one in your photo.
So there may be some screaming in the background now for the next few minutes.
That'll make a nice accompaniment to our chat.
No long-term damage is being done.
How old is your kid?
He's 2.5, Cosmo.
Oh, what a great name.
He's a legend.
How did you get to the name Cosmo?
It was my wife kind of came up with the idea. There were two major influences, one of whom was Cosmo Brown from Singing in the Rain, who's I don't know if you're familiar with that film, but it's the second character, the He's like the comedian, piano player, songwriter, and he's a brilliant character.
Yeah.
And the other one was Kramer from Seinfeld.
Yeah, speaking of Larry David, when you said he's called Cosmo, I was like, oh, it's too good to be true. This is incredible.
Yeah, he is kind of half named after Cosmo Kramer.
Fantastic. That's incredible.
Which is a dubious role model, but between the two of them, it sure should even out somehow.
Oh, that makes me so happy. I'm jealous. I'm going to have to name my own son George.
Yeah.
You know, if you've gone there, then I can safely go there and feel confident, you know, that it's all going to be fine.
You can be fairly confident with George, yeah.
That's fantastic. I was looking at a billboard for that show this morning. There's just so many catchphrases.
Yeah.
It's so... Have you ever seen...
These pretzels are making me thirsty!
Have you ever seen Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee?
Yeah.
Because that's loosely how this podcast came to be. Like, wouldn't it be nice if we all had somewhere to chat where other people would then listen to it? And I thought about doing it in a car. I'd always dreamed of a show called Tea and Drive. But the logistical...
That sounds like a golfing podcast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it does. I never thought of it that way. The implications of a video podcast were just horrifying. And that Comedians in Cars, it's Jerry Seinfeld's web series, which is free. If you're listening to this and you're a bit bored, go and listen to that instead. There's a great episode with Barack Obama when he was still president. It's great.
I've seen a couple of them. They're kind of slightly ambivalent towards it. Not his finest work, I don't think. But,
Interesting.
The one with Louis C.K. is good.
Oh, yeah, I love that. They've got some amazing little animations in there.
Yeah, when he tells the story about when he gets stuck on the boat with
his
kids.
That's the one. Yeah, that's fantastic.
That's a good story.
Bit of work. Yeah. I'd love to get something like that done about my own life.
Yeah.
So, and then I realized Jerry was spending $100,000 an episode to make it look that good. And I was like, oh, maybe the jazz podcast should just be audio.
Wow.
I know.
That's a big budget.
I know. It's a shocker for something that's just a couple of GoPros. And anyway.
He has a lot of Patreon sponsors for him. He's probably got a few quid.
Yeah, I think a company called Crackle pay the whole bill for him.
Right.
Which is why it's not on YouTube. Anyway. I've profoundly digressed, as I will, at the first sniff of a chat about Seinfeld.
So we're talking about Barrack, right?
We were talking about Barrack, yes. And we were talking about your jazz house and the 10 years you lived there. So tell me how that kind of formed such a big basis of your jazz, like you say, your what is it, the higher education?
Further education, I suppose. First of all, that's a lot of musicians to be living together, and that's quite a long period of time to be living together. And we put all of our music in the front room, all the CDs, and, you know, just made each other listen to everything that we already knew. So, you know, just spent hours and hours listening and buying new stuff and checking out new stuff and playing loads. You know, we had two different spaces in the house where we could play till late in the night. My room was one of the main spaces to play, so I had my kit and my vibes and a piano set up in there.
Sweet.
Permanently. And we had a bass player in the house, you know. It was like a jazz workshop, basically.
Sweet.
And we started putting on a few gigs of people's bands who were rehearsing, because a lot of people were using our house to rehearse as well. People who had bands doing original music and having plays and things like that. To try people's compositions out. They were using our house to rehearse, and so we started putting on a couple of nights. One of which was the first one was at a place called the North London Tavern, in Kilburn. And Barrett was running the jam session down at Camden, down in Camden at the Jazz Cafe at that time. And so we started doing some gigs there. And he kind of noticed what we were doing and basically said, "You guys are a collective. This, you're what everything that you're doing is basically the, you know, you're building a community and you're using that community to promote each other and promote the music and give each other a platform and develop the music. And cool. you should make this a thing and use it to your advantage." So we were like, "Oh, okay." Because he the other thing we haven't said about Barrack is he formed the Fire Collective.
Yeah.
Which was a pretty important collective in London that a lot of bands like Acoustic Ladyland, I guess, were and Polar Bear. I think Polar Bear started as a fire band. But a lot of musicians, Ingrid Laubrook,
they had a record label as well, didn't they?
Sorry?
Did they release albums? Because I think Round Trip.
Yeah, they still do. They still have the Fire Presents label. It's still going as a collective, but it had been going for maybe, I don't know, a little under 10 years, maybe 5 or 10 years at this time, and had kind of done a bunch of work. And but I think Barrack saw us as maybe like the next people to kind of emerge. So he really encouraged us and gave us a lot of advice. And we formed the Loop Collective.
That's amazing.
And the Loop Collective is still going and has done a bunch of, you know, bunch of festivals and weekly nights we set up. Well, the North London Tavern relocated to the Oxford.
Oh, wow. That's how that worked
and
out.
So the Oxford is only just stopped like middle of last year, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And we were doing that since 2005.
Man, it's such a shame that stopped after such a long run.
And I must say credit to George Crowley for keeping it running so long after Loop handed it over to him.
Yeah.
He was running that and the Con pretty much single-handedly. He's still doing the Con, which he took over, which he kind of re-established after Richard Turner died.
Yeah, I was just going to say about Richard, because his album Round Trip was on the Fire Collective
Correct.
Label.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, if you're listening, if you've never been to the Con Cellar Bar in Camden is a once in a lifetime experience. I'd recommend above all others as like the coolest jazz venue in town.
It's got an amazing atmosphere and it's a real community hub. You get to see great bands really, really intimate proximity, and there's always, you know, loads of musicians and dedicated music fans down there. It makes it a really exciting place to be as a player or as a listener.
Yeah, if someone came to London, especially somewhere like New York, you know, and you could only show them one venue, I would so proudly be like, "Check this out," you know.
Yeah.
Much rather take them there than Ronnie's. No disrespect to Ronnie's, but.
Yeah, it's just, you know, musically it's very dedicated to contemporary and really interesting it's, you know, doesn't have a commercial edge to it whatsoever. It's just about creative music. So
yeah,
I'd agree.
So
kind of like the Vortex is.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what it was like to, what's it been like moving? I guess we're back near where we started now, deciding to move to France and then finding new, what kind of stuff are you doing now?
So, of my kind of UK based stuff, I'm still doing, my band, which is nominally based in the UK, where the trio is at least, Cloudmaker's Trio. Which is Dave Smith, who was one of the guys from the Jazz House, and Mike Janish on bass. who we've been playing together since 2010, and done a few albums now, a bunch of touring. Nice. And so that's kind of a UK based band because it started there.
Yeah,
and we're still living there. And then with the Cloudmakers 5, which is the trio plus Hannes Riepler on guitar.
Oh yeah.
And a great alto and clarinet player from Paris called Antonin Trihuang. And we've done about 3 weeks touring so far this year, playing all new music. And
oh, cool.
A live album.
Where have you been touring?
Just in the UK so far, but kind of a bit all over. Done about 20 dates, I think, so far this year. Two of those were at the Vortex, where we recorded a live album, so that will be out later this year.
Oh, cool. That sounds awesome.
And then the other kind of main... Well, there's two other things that I'm doing in the UK, one is playing with Ivo Neem.
Yeah.
We've done loads of different stuff together over the years, but now we're doing a project called Duo Plus, which is him on piano and organ and mellotron and Rhodes and various different keyboards. I play vibes and drums in it. And we're kind of recording an album recording and producing an album, which we're doing over a period of time rather than like as a jazz album going in and playing it all live. We're doing it bit by bit. Just doing some gigs. I mean, we've been doing duo gigs over the years, but this is a kind of a new approach to it.
Yeah.
So we've been writing some new music for it. Okay. So that's one of the things. And then the other is a band called Vouloviel, which is run by Bex Birch, who plays the Ghanaian djil, which is a Ghanaian xylophone.
Cool.
Sounds really nice. And that's a trio with Ruth Goller on bass and myself on drums.
Yeah.
Again, that's a kind of a new incarnation of an older relationship and a band which has done different things, but that's how it looks now. So those things are keeping me coming back to the UK. Yes. As is my post teaching at the Royal Academy. I teach vibes and I teach some other one-to-one.
Oh, cool. That's lessons. An awesome job.
Yeah, I love it.
How long have you done that for?
I've been there for about 5 years.
Wow. Do you do any like ensemble projects?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been to the last 3 years. I've gone in. They do an international jazz festival every February, half term. And I've done that for the last three years, going for a week, because usually the way they run their ensembles is you go in like once a week over 3 weeks, and then in the fourth week they do a concert.
Yeah.
But that's a little tricky for me to do. So Nick's been great in asking me to do this international festival.
Oh, nice.
Where I can go and be there for a whole week and do 3 days rehearsals.
Yeah.
And then a concert on the fourth day or the third or fourth day, depending.
Yeah.
So that's really great. It's amazing going in and taking. I generally take mostly my music, although the last couple of years I've taken in music from Marius Nesset and from Ivo as well to play with the students. Cool. And hearing what those guys do with it. I mean, the level there is just incredible, and they really work hard. And
yeah.
It's really fun. You can really get into playing.
But it's amazing to still have a young ex-student in yourself going in there to teach, because it also acts as a great motivator for everyone to see that these opportunities will be made for you, you know, if you're like putting in the work and
right
place, you know. I mean, if the whole college was only like filled with like 55 and above, like really established sort of legendary teachers, then everyone would be bumming around way more, I know, than like getting you showing up is awesome.
Well, I mean, Nick is really fantastic at getting a, a really wide range of teachers, and you know, the faculty is really big, and he's really got his eye on the who's around as well. Like, when, you know, whenever anyone, any of the kind of American musicians are over in the UK on tour, you know, Nick will get in touch and be like, hey, come in for a day, teach the improvisation class or teach some one-to-ones. And, you know, they've got people going in there all the time from all over. It's a really, really vibrant course. And the students they're spoiled rotten, really, with the amount of people they got coming in.
Yeah.
Of course, they're paying £9,000 a year for it. So I guess spoiled rotten is maybe not fair, but Nick is really doing a great job there. So yeah, I feel very privileged to be part of that.
Yeah,
that institution, that part of that community.
Absolutely.
So I come out buzzing, you know, every time.
Like, I can imagine. Yeah,
you're just getting to talk about really, really high level, inspiring subjects and play, you know, the fact that it's fun for me because I play piano and I play drums and vibes, and so I can, and I don't just see drummers and vibes players. I've had bass players, guitarists, saxophone players come to me in one-to-ones, and I can play with them because I play drums with them, or I play piano with them, and or play vibes with them, and it's like, that's really fun, you know. That's a really, I've always enjoyed that way of teaching. I think my first ever teacher was like that, Russ Davis, the guy I mentioned earlier.
Yeah,
he would always play piano with me when I was playing drums or playing xylophone, and it's, you know, that's the best way to learn.
Absolutely.
I guess that's what I mean about the house as well, like the further education thing.
Yeah,
like we were just doing so much playing, and that's yeah, for me that's the best way to learn, playing and listening.
Yeah, those were always my favorite teachers as well at college, and the gigs that really stuck with me and like ensemble projects. Remember, we did one with Gareth LaCrane, and Gareth just played all the time. He took solos on every tunes, and you know, it was amazing because you're like, man, this is sick. And the same with Martin France. I did one with him once, and he was playing loads of drums, and you're like, this is the best. Like, this is better than anything anyone could ever say to me. You know, just this feeling of playing with people and getting a feeling of their powers.
yeah, and their sound and their way of. I mean, I just as you were saying that, I remember speaking to a trumpet player. It's one of the guys from the Lincoln Center band. I can't remember his name for a second, but he said, "Do you know Kenny Wheeler?" And I said, "Well, I've met him and I've played with him, you know, played with him once or twice." And he said, "If you ever see him again, can you just tell him from me, thank you, because I studied with him at Banff." And he said that he wasn't like the most amazing teacher in terms of information, but just being in the room with him and being with his sound was one of the most important things, you know, that ever happened to me as a trumpet player.
Oh wow.
And I was lucky enough to get to see Kenny again to pass that on to him, and I could remember his name at the time.
Wow, nice work.
I just thought that's kind of stuck with me, that was, you know, that being up close to musicians is a really profound way of learning from them and playing with them as well. And that's something that I feel lucky to have done a lot of, certainly my time in the UK, is playing with a lot of the older generation musicians. People like Pete King and Bobby Wellens, and I played in Martin Drew's band for a long time, and sort of through that connection I was in John Dankworth's band playing with Cleo Lane, and I don't know, playing with people who are a lot older and have been doing it for their whole lives, and who have also themselves played with a lot of people who are really close to the source, you know, close to the start of the music, because it's still such a young art form.
Yeah.
Those lessons, you know, those have been real learning periods for me. Phrasing and sound and all that kind of stuff, you just absorb it, really.
Totally. I was just thinking Kit Down said the same thing, that he's always loved trying to make a point of playing with that generation of people. And you've done the Neon Quartet with Stan Saltzman as well. Which is really cool. So tell me about the Jim Hart life goals for like the future.
Well, I'm really enjoying touring. Since moving to France, I'm doing less projects. I'm doing maybe 6 or 7 bands at the moment, which is less than I've kind of done on average. I've always kind of had like maybe 10 bands on the go, which has always felt too many, I've felt a little suffocated from it. And the moving to France was, I definitely saw that as an opportunity to try and have a bit of a cull there and really just try and focus on fewer things and things that I care really deeply about. I'm kind of in that situation now, which is great. So I'm really enjoying touring, and I'm really enjoying playing with these bands and having time when I'm not touring to practice and prepare for those gigs. You know, I try and play from memory now, always, like with every band. So I like to have all the music internalized, and I like to be really kind of inside things from a kind of improvisational.
Man, that's a lot of effort as well to be soaking that.
It kind of gets easy. I found it like when I joined Marius's band, Marius Nesset's band, everyone was playing all the music from memory, and I found it quite a struggle to begin with to get up to that level of being able to learn things. But having done that for a few years now and trying to apply it to all the other bands, I mean, I've always done it with my own band, but that's different because I kind of memorize it as I'm now I just try and do it with all the bands, and it just gets easier. It's a muscle, I think.
I remember I memorized Pete Lee's band Narcissus, their charts once, and it took me ages because I hadn't done it before. And all these like middle parts and bits of writing that weren't the melody, like, took me a while to get my brain around those.
And then there's like the form and the structure as well. Then you're like, you've memorized all the bits, and then you're like, oh god, but what happens next? Actually, what's the next big, you know, you start, there's the kind of the big shape, and then all the small detail shapes, they're kind of different parts of the brain, I guess, remember different bits. I'm kind of happy with the volume of touring work that I have, and I'd like to for that to carry on for a while yet. I'm going to be 39 this year, so I'd still like to be touring at that kind of intensity for another 10 years. But teaching is something that I really, really enjoy. And I would be very happy to think that, you know, maybe 10 years down the line that I would tour a little less, because it is tiring. And I'd be happy to teach more. There's a few conservatoires around where I live. There's a few cities, there's Basel in Switzerland. And Strasbourg in France, they both have good conservatoires. So, I don't know. And I'm teaching privately. I think the online teaching thing is gonna develop as well as a technology. And I'm very up for staying in touch with seeing how that goes.
Yeah,
it's something that I really enjoy, and I'd also like to document some of the stuff that I've. Because the more teaching I do, the more I find I come back to. I often come back to the same things. I find the same things are applicable to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So there could be some kind of book or books. One, I don't know. There's also like this rhythm versus harmonic melodic stuff that were I've taken things that I work on the drums, rhythmic stuff, and have applied that in a kind of a scale pattern ways. There's a bit of a thing developing there. It's still developing really, but I think there could be some interesting stuff there that has maybe not been, that I haven't seen written down before. So I don't know, whatever, that's a possible future development.
Nice. That sounds cool.
Mm.
There's not that many books about.
It's too many books.
Too many. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never been a big book guy really, but.
Did you know Nick Smart is writing a book?
Yeah. He's writing the Kenny Wheeler biography, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite a big.
Yeah. It's going to be a good read.
Yeah, it will be. That's quite a spicy meatball to get into.
Yeah.
Last time I spoke to him about it, he'd already been working on it for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, damn.
He's a busy man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's doing it really, I mean, he's really going into depth. And last time I saw him, he'd just come back from, I think he was in Munich. He went to visit to interview Manfred Eicher for a couple of days. So he's doing quite a lot of that, going and traveling and meeting people who knew Kenny well and getting different stories and different angles for it. So,
nice.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be well worth waiting for.
Here's my last question for you. What's the last album you bought?
Ouch. I'm not sure. I know what some of the last albums that I got hold of.
That's totally doable.
Yeah, because I was out at BMC Records in Budapest with this trio, Velvet Revolution, that I play with, and we've been there twice, and they just take us down to the vault and basically fill our suitcases up.
Sweet, that's amazing.
I've still got them mostly in a pile to listen to. The last CD that I kind of acquired that I've been listening to a lot is La Petite Moutarde by Tio Sicaldi, who is the violinist in this trio Velvet Revolution that I play with.
Yeah.
Which is I think it's an oldish record of his. It was from a few years, certainly. And that's, yeah, that's been really enjoying listening to that record. That's great.
Nice. That was not a name I've heard. Time for some research.
Yeah. He's a great musician. It's a really nice trio. It's the music of Daniel Erdman, who's the saxophonist, tenor saxophonist, whose band it is.
Yeah.
He's German, but he's lived in France for about 15 years, I think.
Cool.
And it's a trio with Daniel Erdman and myself on vibes and Tio Sicaldi on violin and viola. It's called Velvet Revolution. We've got an album out on BMC and, quite busy touring this year in France and Germany, which has been, yeah, kind of just, we just did a week and we got a load more stuff coming up. It's really fun.
Oh, nice. Well, me and Dan love a bit of research, so that album can go. We like to do this thing where we both listen to it and then we talk about it. And normally he listens to it straight away and it takes me ages. So we can have some fun with that.
Cool.
Nice. All right, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great talking to you.
Pleasure. Yeah, thank you again for making the time to come on the Jazz Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, Dan, I enjoyed that a lot.
Jim Jiminy, Jim Jiminy, Jim Jim Jeroo.
Yeah, it was It was illuminating. I feel bad. Actually, a lot of the guests recently have had very similar life stories. I didn't realise that Jim had gone to Chet's until he told me that.
You need to get better at the research, I think, Rob.
Yeah, I know. I need to.
You're dropping the ball.
Big time ball drops going on.
Your balls have dropped.
Yeah, and it's creating problems for the listeners.
Yeah, who's on the next show?
So next week is Raph Clarkson.
Well, next fortnight.
Next fortnight is Raph Clarkson.
He's a trombone player, yeah?
Yeah, that's the one. He's a trombonist. He's like 31 years of age, possibly. Yeah.
Did he go to Chet's?
No, he didn't. He has a much more weaving, curious life story.
Not that Jim doesn't,
but Raph didn't study at music college, so
right.
His path
he's
towards,
not as good as the others.
No, exactly. He's just not quite as good as.
That was a joke. I'm sorry, Raph.
Oh no, that was marvelous. So, actually, Raph's is also a video show.
Oh, okay.
Film the entire interview, and it will be on YouTube the same day that the audio show comes out, but it doesn't matter. Like, if you just listen to us as audio, as always, it will make perfect sense. But if you're itching to see the glamour behind a jazz podcast interview, then you can. I think any that we do in person will be filmed from this point on. And I've created a new intro for the video shows.
You have?
It's absolutely stunning.
I haven't heard about this.
In fact, I should have a finished file. I'll send it to you and
get
your approval. Raph, in 2 weeks, and tonight, as you listen to this on June. It's June the 9th.
Or it might be on the 10th or the 11th.
Oh, sorry. I was going somewhere.
Is there some current news?
There's some big time current news for tonight, which is that this evening at the Concelebar, there's a situation going down. I can tell you right now. George Crowley, who runs the con, has sent me a text, and it says, "Ooh," with 7 O's. If you're doing a pod soon, can you tell people about this gig? Friday the 9th, Mike Chillingworth. Well, it says Chiller's Fortet with Nick Costley-White, Callum Gourlay and James Madron, plus a new trio. Oh, God, that bing will have come right through. Sorry.
That is a big faux pas.
Crumbs. George has sent me a text. That is a big faux pas. The voice of reason, that was great. Apologies, that was George.
Right, just power through.
Yeah, so the quartet and a new trio of George Crowley's with Rob Luft and Tim Giles. You can get tickets at concellarjazz.com, or you can just go to the con if you live...
And wing it.
You wing it, absolutely. It's the coolest jazz venue in Britain.
One day, Rob, we should do a live episode, and we should probably do it there.
That would be awesome. We should
show up. We should hire a canal boat and show up by canal.
Yes. We should pay for a film crew as well.
Or we could get those Manchester guys, Salford guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They'll do it for free.
Yeah, they will.
So you've got a camera now.
I do. I could film us, except I'd need to be on the shore to do it.
What, like the as opposed to the sea?
Oh, I see what you mean. I just had this idea in my brain that it would look really glamorous by us being on the boat and someone on the it's not called the shore, is it? It's just it's just the canal,
the wayside
thing, the wall.
Yeah,
that bit that the horse used to walk along.
Yeah, they still in Godalming. They do that. They do a horse-drawn canal boat.
Wow, have you
down
been
the river? Not yet.
Let's do it together.
That would be great.
It's called a towpath, which just come back to me.
Towpath, there you go.
Stand on the towpath and someone can film us floating into the con.
Nice.
All right, well, on that note of floating, I think it's time to go.
Yeah.
So, from me, from Dan.
Yeah.
and from Jim, we'll see you on Friday.
In 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. In 2 weeks on Friday.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Jazz Podcast.
Jazz Podcast.
That was delightful.
Yes.
Perfect.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Great.